Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Welcome, welcome, welcome to this installment of Rated LGBT Radio. We are glad you're here. We have a really great show for you lined up today. In fact, we are doing the world premiere of a new song that you need to hear, especially if you have any interest in the future of our planet and climate change and global warming and all of those. This will be not only a song you'll want to hear, it's one you need to hear and you need to play for other people. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Our artist today is Ann Stott, and we're kind of on a roll here with our musical friends. We had Tom Goss 2 weeks ago, David Archuleta last week, and Ann this week. So we're just going to keep the hits on coming because all of this is really incredible, great music that you need to partake in. And, of course, there's a lot of noise out there about music, so we're creating the music above the noise by listening. But Ann is incredibly multi-talented. She is more than a singer-songwriter. She's got a lot of fingers and a lot of artistic pies. She has done two albums, one called Love Never Dies and the other called Pennsylvania Lyrics. She is about to come out with another album called Born Under a Full Moon. I believe the single Born Under a Full Moon is already out, and her latest single, which we are premiering today, will be coming out, and it's called Water to Blood. Water to Blood is this outstanding anthem. Again, it comes right at you with the issue of climate change, and I think some of the frustration that virtually nothing has been done about it, So that's why I think it has even elevated importance. But like I said, we're going to play it for you today. It actually launches later this week to coincide with Earth Day. I think that's tomorrow. So you're getting at least one day's heads up on that. Besides her musical talent and her musical expression, Ann has also done a lot of theater, so she brings that artistic bent to the table. She has acted in a film, and so we're going to talk to her about all of that. Not to mention, her latest work is produced by Barb Morrison, who is a friend of the show, and we had Barb on to talk about their book, Bottoming for God, and we've also had Tripping Jupiter, who is another Barb Morrison artist, on. So Ann fits right into that family, and we're excited to talk to her. First, though, I am bringing on Brody Levesque. Brody is the editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Blade magazine. He's also the producer of the show. But the Los Angeles Blade magazine, which you can find at losangelesblade.com, is the journalistic platform you need to avail yourself every single day. It has a continual flow of new and original journalism stories. It is the winner of the GLAAD Media Award from this last year. And so proud to be part of that. And welcome to the show, Brody, and what is going on?
Hey, Rob, good afternoon and good afternoon, good morning and good day to our listeners around the globe. We appreciate you subscribing and downloading the podcast. And thank you for your continued support. Michigan State University police and public safety officials confirmed that a group of seven suspects were identified, and they assaulted two victims this past Monday at the Michigan State University main library. According to MSU police, they confirmed that the victims were selected because of their perceived sexual orientation, and they are going to ask the Ingham County, Michigan's prosecutor's office for hate crime charges. MSU vice president and a spokesperson for the university, Emily Gallant, said that two MSU students were followed into the library by these seven non-MSU students. According to the vice president, these appeared to be students of high school age. According to the Lansing State Journal and the police, they followed the two MSU students up to the third floor study area, at which point a physical assault, which was later posted to social media, occurred. And so we're looking at, again, another hate crime. In kind of more brighter news than that, yesterday, Time Magazine released its 100 most influential people of 2024. And Elliot Page, author, actor, and artist, made the list. Human Rights Campaign President Kelly Robinson, a friend of the show, a shout out to Kelly. She made the list. Someone that I have met, I was deeply honored to interview and got to know a few years ago, Frank Mugisha. Frank is the executive director of Sexual Minorities Uganda, which is a Ugandan LGBTQ rights group. I met Frank in 2014 as I was covering the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Human Rights Awards. This is an award that's handed out by the Kennedy Center. Now, this is the Robert F. Kennedy Center in New York every year. Also, Rosanna Fleming Kalarenda, who is a queer activist in Sri Lanka, and she had led the efforts to decriminalize consensual same-sex relations in Sri Lanka, also made the list. Also on the Time 100 list was Chef Dominique Krenn, healthcare advocate Ophelia Dahl, fashion designer Jonathan Anderson. So a shout out to all of our LGBTQ folk who made the Time 100, and that's a really cool thing. In Arizona on Wednesday, Arizona Democratic Governor, On Tuesday, Arizona Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed another one of the onerous trans bills that has been flying around across virtually all of the lower 48 states. She made it clear in some of the vetoes that she's made during this past legislative season that she's just not up to having the LGBTQ plus community discriminated against. She's voted, she's vetoed 13 of those bills. So the total count for the governor for all vetoed bills and legislation were 42. Of note, the other bill that she vetoed on Tuesday would have been a law requiring teachers to post the Ten Commandments, or green lighting them, the ability to post the Ten Commandments in their classrooms, which of course obviously is a little violation of church and state, not that the Christian right seems to care about that at all. So hats off to the governor. Thank you very much. We appreciate that greatly. My White House reporter and colleague Chris King reported yesterday that in a 10-page report, which was released Tuesday by the staff of the Democratic majority of the United States Senate Finance Committee, the Republican attorneys general of Tennessee, Missouri, India, and Texas are accused of using abusive legal demands to collect medical records of transgender parents, and this is in furtherance of their ideological and political goals. In the case of Texas in particular, Ken Paxton has gone after clinics in Georgia, Washington State, Colorado, and a couple of other places, demanding trans records of trans youth who were getting treated in these clinics. These are, in fact, residents of Texas. So he is tenuously clinging to the idea that he can get these records and pull them. The biggest disclosure, however, and the biggest problem was the Office of Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scarametti, who's made no secret of his hatred of our community, who allegedly was investigating and running a probe into potential misuse in quotation marks, of Medicaid funds. And he went after Vanderbilt University. Vanderbilt, which is located in Nashville, has one of the largest clinics that treat gender dysphoria and transgender youth in terms of trans health care. This is, again, something that we have been reporting on at the Blade for a while. And so now the Senate Finance Committee majority came out and said, yep, that's abusive, shouldn't be doing it. And the last story that I kind of wanted to cover, because I think it's really important, the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, now this is not the University of California at LA, that's UCLA, this is different, this is USC, for our listeners that need the difference, decided to cancel the commencement address of Asna Tabassum. She's a pro-Palestinian and Muslim undergraduate, and she was picked originally back in April because of, you know, obviously her grade point average and everything else. Apparently some of the things that she said in her private online social media got the university nervous. They claimed that they were canceling her speech because of, quote, safety concerns. But the reality of it is, and according to the Council on American Islamic Relations, Los Angeles, which is abbreviated CARE LA, yeah, it was probably not because of that. The university was underlying saying, well, it's anti-Semitism. And in response to the USC people canceling her speech, Tasumba said this. She thought it was a result of a campaign of hate aimed at silencing her dissent with the situation on the ground in Gaza. And then she said, anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian voices have subjected me to a campaign of racist hatred because of my uncompromising belief in human rights for all. I have actually looked at her social media posts. There was nothing in there that would indicate anything about the state of Israel. She was doing what virtually every university student that's got a conscience has been protesting about for probably the better part of the last few months, loudly, about the acts and, for lack of a better description, of genocide being committed by Israeli Defense Forces against the Palestinians in Gaza. You know, I'm sure that's probably going to get us some hate mail, but I'm sorry. You know, I reported from South Africa. I can tell you what apartheid's like. And I've seen for myself some of the actions of the Israeli Defense Force, and what they're doing is inexcusable. So for USC to sit there and buckle and say, no, we're not going to have a valedictorian, you know, speak, especially one who's Muslim, you know, and of color, it's just like, USC, no thank you. And that's it, Rob.
Okay. Well, thanks for your opinion on that, Brody. And we will move on. Okay, and now I'd like to welcome Anne to the program. Anne, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, very excited to talk to you. And we have your song loaded up, so at a certain point I do want to play that with your permission.
Oh, of course.
We'll wait a few minutes on that. I want to get the right setup. But take us back. I mean, you started out kind of, I don't want to say nomad, but you had quite amount of movement in your young life. You were born in, I think, New England and to Europe and then back and ended up in New York City. Tell us, what was your youth like?
Sometimes I like to say I'm from everywhere and nowhere because I was actually born outside of Philadelphia, but we left when I was 18 months old. So I have no personal memories from there, even though I have a lot of family history there. And then we moved to Luxembourg randomly and then England. And actually, my earliest memories are from living in England. So even though we weren't there, we were there about 3 years, but it was really formative for me. And then my father got a job in Minneapolis, and we had no family history in Minneapolis, but I did spend most of my childhood in Minneapolis, which is a great place to grow up. And, you know, I'm still connected to people there, but none of my family's from there. And my mother's the only one who still lives there. And the truth is that we visited New York when I was 10 or 11. I had a great aunt who I'm named after, actually, who lived in New York City her whole life. And we went to visit her and it was like, I'm moving here. Like, this is home. And I went to New York City as soon as I could. And I lived there full time for 20 years. And now I've been on Cape Cod for quite some time, but I still spend a lot of time in New York.
Well, I don't blame you for that at all. It's funny. I have got a similar background to yours, and not in the same places, actually none of the same places, but mine was when I was 10, we moved to Italy and lived in Italy for 3.5 years. And like you,
oh, wow.
It's like that one little speck of my life is very defining. I mean, it's like
when you're young, I mean, you're taking in so much information about the world and everything around you, and then to be immersed in another culture, I actually think it's a great thing. And even still, it doesn't happen that much anymore, but once every couple of years, somebody will reference something American from the time when we were in England, and I'll be like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they'll be like, really? How do you not know? And I'm like, I don't know. And then I'm like, oh, wait, I wasn't here.
You know? I hear you. Yeah. And there in Italy, it was even more so, just because all the media was in Italian, and I didn't speak Italian by the time we left, I could understand it, but it wasn't like, mm-hmm. what my childhood would have been if I was in the United States, where, you know, I would have been watching TV all the time and all that. But I agree with you. It's like, it is part of it that's formative about it is, at least for me, was I knew what it felt like at that age, even though it was from a privileged standpoint, to know what it felt like to be an outsider. And because mm-hmm. over there, I was constantly dealing with what is an American and having to, ooh. Dispel their perceptions of all Americans and all that. So it wasn't anything detrimental, like, and I'm not trying to compare that to people who have had very discriminatory experiences that way, but just the mindset of I'm in somebody else's arena and kind of navigating that.
Totally. I mean, I think any experience that helps us, like, open our compassion to other human experience is a good thing. And I mean, I even had that coming. I mean, my memories of that are more distinct coming back to the United States, because again, I was so young when we went to England that I don't remember that. But I remember being in school in music class back in the United States, and I didn't know the national anthem. And the teacher, like, dressed me down in front of the whole class.
Oh, geez.
And I was
like,
I haven't been living here, you know? And then she kind of, you know, backed off a little, and she was like, well, you better learn it quickly. You know?
Oh, my Jesus.
And it's like,
oh, my God.
That, you know, that kind of, kind of dictatorial, like, this is our culture, and if you don't know it, you're not okay, kind of attitude, you know, is informative, you know? So, yeah, I think you can learn so much
from
being in other cultures.
Yeah, I totally get that. I think for me, and I relate to that in kind of reverse, it's like, because when we did go to Italy, the other part of that, and reflecting the kind of the American culture that you're talking about, was observing other Americans over there with us and their behavior and their imposition on the culture and expecting everything to be done the way it is in America. And well, in America, that's not how it's like, we're not in America. Shut up. You know, it's like,
right.
You know, that was actually a source of embarrassment for me. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe you guys are acting this way. It's like, I don't want anyone to be associated with you, that, you know, that imposition, but it is, I think those are very transformative, and how do you feel like that has influenced your work? Is a lot of your music, which is, I would almost encourage people to read your lyrics as well as listen to the songs, because I think there's a lot in the poetry that you write as a part of your songs. But how do you feel like that feeling informed you for what you express later?
Oh, thanks for saying that. I don't want to overstate this because, you know, I am a white woman living in the United States, which is in some ways an incredibly privileged existence, right? So I don't want to, like you were saying, I don't want to like overdo this, right? But
right.
I do think having that experience so young gives me just a bigger window on, and also I was in England, so I mean, same language technically, and you know, there was a lot of similarity, but then a lot of difference, but it gives me a bigger window on our politics, you know what I mean? Like there's a mm-hmm. sort of, again, I think there's a knee-jerk nationalism that I just don't identify with. You know, and, you know, right-wing people might say that's, like, criminal or something, but I just think, you know, and I think, you know, my willingness maybe to be more critical of our government and how it behaves in certain situations might be partially informed from having this experience of being outside the country and in another experience, you know? So, yeah, I think it just opens your window to more points of view. I don't think it's directly influenced my songwriting, but I think it's a part of my political point of view, which is a pretty big thing in my world. And I think definitely like not being as invested in this idea of like our country is the greatest country in the world no matter what. It's like, well, let's look at our country. There are things about our country that are great, that I appreciate, that I celebrate. There are things about our country, you know, I mean, there's that sort of, you know, you referenced it, like European kind of like, oh, Americans. But then there are things they love about us, our optimism,
mm-hmm.
the ability to start new things, you know what I mean? Like there are things about American culture that are truly great. And then there are, you know, huge problems, huge blind spots, you know, obviously the history, our own history of, you know, genocide of the native people and our attachment to slavery long after, you know, our partners in slavery in Europe had made it illegal, you know,
right.
Like we can say, oh, everybody had slavery, but we hung on a really long time, you know, in a despicable way. So,
yeah.
I think,
I agree with you.
Let's just take stock of ourselves, honestly, you know?
Yeah. And that's what I see kind of in your work is that ability to take that observational eye, you know, that comes through in your work. And I agree with you. It's like for me, you know, it's like I was aware of slavery. In fact, I'm really shocked of some of the whitewashing that has been going on lately to try to downplay it. It's like, what are you talking about? We always knew. It's like I always got this education in school. I knew about slavery. I knew about, you know, that being a dark spot on our country. What I didn't know as well as I'm learning is how pervasive the slavery culture continued on, particularly in the South, because I wasn't living in the South. You know, it's like, and didn't experience that firsthand. Wasn't what was passed down to me.
No, and then we get this story of like slavery ended and everybody needs to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. But, you know, if you do dig in, you learn like the laws that different states passed, so there was an extra tax if a black citizen wanted to do anything other than be a domestic worker or a field worker, or, you know, in some states a black person couldn't own a gun, so then they couldn't hunt. You know what I mean? It just just at every turn, Black Americans were blocked from having any kind of possibility to enrich their lives. And the whitewashing, the, I mean, we're in such a complicated time right now around censorship. And I really appreciated what Brody said about USC, and I'm very much for, you know, an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and, you know, an evaluation of the occupation there. And, you know, the right wing is so good at spinning, right? And so they have everyone on the right thinking that the left is censoring people. Meanwhile, they're the ones literally passing laws to make books about gay kids illegal, passing laws to make teaching, you know, the history of Black people in America illegal. And now supposedly, suddenly, now I'm sort of going off the weekend, but, you know, suddenly the right wing, like these people who literally support a man for president who has white nationalists backing him, suddenly care about anti-Semitism on campuses. And I want to say, like, I am opposed to anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a real living thing. We need to look at it and address it in all its forms. I don't think anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are the same thing. That's a bigger conversation for another time. But, like,
agreed.
The right wing doesn't care about anti-Semitism. The right wing cares about manipulating a schism that's happening on the left right now, and they're using censorship to push that schism
100%.
As far as they can.
Yep. Yeah, no.
So
we're in a
really complicated time when it comes to censorship in our country.
And perception, because to your point, it's like the funnel of information and the attempt to stop it down. I mean, it's like we really are at the advent of fascism, and it is just really appalling what gets pushed forth and in question. Yeah. So yeah, on the same page on that. I'm going to pivot us though, because I clearly,
and I don't think it's a big pivot. I want to say, So I don't think a song about the climate is actually that huge a pivot from what we're talking about, because
I was going to go back to you performing on the street and being discovered,
we can talk about that.
Actually, it's a great point. I'll come back to that later, but you know, I think you've just queued us up perfectly for Water to Blood. So let's go ahead and put that on there, because that completely fits. So pivoting slightly to the issue of climate change, which, by the way, nobody in power is talking about anymore, like it just went away until the next big storm or disaster happens, sort of like, you know, the gun lobby and another gun incident. But Anne's new song, Water to Blood, is, I think, going to be the song for Earth Day, and should be the song that resonates with everybody on an ongoing basis, because it calls it out in no uncertain terms about the issue of climate change. And here it is, and turn up the volume.
You can squeeze the earth till it's dry.
Time is here now, it's not coming, it's coming.
gonna take? Water to blood. Time is here now. It's not coming. It's come. What's it gonna take? Water to blood. Time is here now.
It's not coming. It's come.
What's it gonna take? What's it gonna take?
Water to blood.
Time is here now.
It's not coming, it's come.
What's it gonna take?
Water to blood.
Oof. Well, first of all, thank you for creating that. Not that there wasn't something to inspire it, but what did give you the impetus to make that statement right now and have that prioritized?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's just so much frustration and such a sense of urgency that is not, you know, that's being stymied really by corporate greed, right? And the song started, I was looking back in my notebooks the other day anticipating the release, and the language started coming out in 2020, which was such an apocalyptic time, right? Like, we were in lockdown, and then the fires, and there had been floods, and then the politics, and then George Floyd was murdered. And I was doing a lot of, you know, just free form writing and this kind of big language was coming out because everything felt so big. And then the language started kind of separating itself into really two different songs, this song about climate and then another song that'll be on the album called White Lies about racism. So it came out of that time, and that's where that kind of apocalyptic language comes from, because it's so obvious, and a majority of Americans want us to be doing more about the environment, and we can't because there are companies that are, you know, strangling our democratic process. So
yeah,
I mean, there's more to it than that, but you know, these companies know that there's an end game. You know, the plastics industry, the chemical industry, the oil industry, they all know exactly what they're doing. And they're doing some things to make it better. I mean, all the car companies are now making electric cars, and, you know, but basically the plastic industry and the oil industry are hanging on until they earn every last penny from, you know, exploiting the planet.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and I guess the biggest frustration I have is, while that's all in the background, it's their enablers, which to me, their biggest enabler is sitting in a courtroom right, as we speak probably right now.
Taking a nap while on trial.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, there's so much noise around the election and issues and all this stuff. And this is one that isn't being discussed, is that if certain factions get into power among the whole horrific menu, which they are set to produce, rolling back things are not even enough to make a dent in this, will be completely demolished. And we'll go back to, you know, really a even more cataclysmic process that is going to even bring this all on sooner and sooner. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, the disinformation, is that there is a concerted effort to trying to keep the information separate. That doesn't cause this. That does. We can do this anyway. And, oh, it's just coincidental that we have fires we've never had before and floods we've never had before and ice caps are melting and all of that. And, you know, it's, I really hope that among the other issues that, you know, the Gen Zers are voting on, that they are conscious of this. And that's why I love your song coming out at this time. It's like, I want my sons to hear it. I want them to own that. And I love the line, it's not coming, it's come. You know, it's like, it's not, oh, in the future, this is going to be a problem. It's now. It's right now. You know, so I'm fanboying all over it.
Thank you. No, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And even I have to, I mean, I wrote that, right? And then I was in New York City last summer on that terrible day when the wildfires made the air in New York worse than Beijing. Like it, and it was, yeah. it was really scary. I mean, it was like something out of a horror movie. And I was talking to my girlfriend about it that night, and she was like, we have to stop calling these things anomalies. Like mm-hmm. the anomalies are no longer anomalies. You know what I mean? Like, and even I was doing it like, oh my God, this distinct event. And it's like, no, like this is the normal now. And it's really scary and it's really hard to sort of own that, you know, because it's scary because we don't know now.
I think it's also that we, because of the way we have our media and everything else, and it's not the media's fault, but it's, you know, we've been conditioned forever to care about things that are in our own backyard more than anything else. Like if a plane goes down in, you know, Asia, you know, our newscasters have to talk about the one American who was on the plane. You know, there's like 500
right.
people lose their lives, but let's talk about the one American that was part of that. And I think a lot of these events are falling into that, because what you just described in New York, we had like the year before out here in California, unprecedented fires. It's like the whole of near where I live, all evacuated, never had been done before. It's like it was, you know, new experience for everybody. And it was very clear to everybody affected by that, you know, this is an effect of climate change. And because we have these enormous dry lightning winds, never had them before, ever. And then we had them. But we look at these as like, oh, it's really terrible that's happening in New York. Oh, poor people. Ooh, glad it's not here. And oh, those tornadoes in the Midwest. Ooh, that's really bad. Ooh, glad it's not here. You know, it's like, and that's the part that, why I think this song is so important, is like, pull it up, people. These are not isolated. These are just fingers of the same thing, you know, happening all over. And it is going to get worse. It's not, you know, it's not going to suddenly go away.
No, it's not going to suddenly go away. I will say I feel very inspired by the youth movements around climate, though. I mean, I know they're not as big in the news right now as they were a year or two ago, but I mean, I feel very inspired by the Sunrise movement. And, you know, there is a lot of engagement around this issue from, you know, people in their 20s, people in their teens. And that is very inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wish they were getting more spotlight, because so many other issues have overshadowed the conversation. And
because everything's
like,
on fire.
I know.
So,
like,
I mean, I have a hard time. Like, I'll roll through the news, and then my girlfriend will say, oh, did you hear, you know, some big thing happened? I'm like, I didn't even get to it. There's just so much going on, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it's, you know, it's sort of the drama of the day. And some of this stuff is, you know, it's like the original film, Inconvenient Truth. It's an inconvenient truth, and people want to avoid it. And they'd rather play in the drama of, you know, outrage of these people are lying and those people are lying and, you know, all of that than, okay, here's some problems that we all need to pull up to the table and solve. You know, it's like we do have a mutual human best interest in solving these problems. These aren't, we don't like those people. We don't want them in our neighborhood, idiocy. These are, none of us are going to survive this if we don't solve it. So,
right. And I mean, I think about, the government doing the Manhattan Project to make the atom bomb. Like, we need that level of commitment, drive, expertise to kind of come together and really look at this from all angles. And I will say that I think there are a lot of people who want to do more and they feel kind of hopeless. And to some extent, that's not their fault. Like, we have shaped this culture around convenience and a lot of, big carbon footprints. And it's very hard to like walk that back individually, right? Like it takes effort. But I want to say for people who do feel sort of hopeless, like little changes make a difference. It doesn't have, like, you don't have to change your whole life today. But like for instance, if you have a dishwasher, stop using the pods that are wrapped in plastic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just stop doing that. You know what I mean? Like the little things, like if you think about it, if you have a dishwasher, let's say you run it twice a week and you use the pods because that is the, if you go to the grocery store now, the main thing for your dishwasher are these pods that are wrapped in plastic. So it takes a second or two of work to like find your way to the bottom shelf for the things that aren't that. Let's say you run your dishwasher twice a week. At the end of the year, that's 100 pieces of plastic that you have not participated in putting into the world. That is something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so you don't have to,
hear you. Yeah.
Change your whole world overnight. Like, do that for 6 months and then look around and say, oh, okay, I'm used to that now. What other new thing can I do? You know?
No, I hear you.
Because it is overwhelming. For me,
it's I shop with I have a set of canvas bags that I take into every grocery store, so they don't have
nice.
To bag or use anything on me. It's like just reuse that every time, and it's amazing the waste that doesn't come from doing that. So yeah, I think every little bit helps. But,
exactly.
And I want to pivot back though. I mean, it's like I know. You and I could have coffee, and we would be there for hours going over the world's problems.
I feel that. I'm having so much fun talking with you. We could just keep going forever, right?
I know, totally. But I want to hear about, so you were performing in the streets of Provincetown, and you got discovered. And I want to hear the story of how that all happened and what happened.
I want to hear that story, too, because I'm not entirely sure I got discovered.
Okay.
But I did.
So what I heard was you were busking in the street, and it was a theater discovery, not music. David Drake discovered you and got you into a play, which.
So that is true. That it was amazing. So. So as a kid, I loved music, theater, and movies, and I was in the school plays, and I was in the choir, and I played piano, and blah, blah, blah. But then when I started making music as an adult, I was really focused on music, and I ended up in Provincetown, and for 5 summers, I played the street really seriously, like 2-hour sets, 5 to 7 days a week. I couldn't go much longer than 2 hours because I was mostly singing in my voice. That was the limit for my voice. But I think, my first summer there, David was there directing a play, and we had met, and then he came to hear me singing. I was singing in front of Town Hall, and he said, "Do you want to be in a play?" And I was like, huh. And I auditioned for him. And I ended up being in a production he did of a play called Poor Superman that was written by Brad Fraser. It's what we call like quote unquote an AIDS play. I don't know how people feel about those monikers around their work now, but it was written in the early 90s, and And the main character is a very successful gay artist who feels like he's lost his mojo and his creative verve. And I played his world weary journalist best friend, Kryla. And it was a great experience. It was a really great experience. And it was like, oh, right, I used to do this. You know, and I felt so honored that David had seen something in me. And actually, David and I have worked together a lot. He's now the artistic director of the Provincetown Theater. We're so lucky to have him. And so we have done a huge body of work together over the last 10 years that I'm really proud of and feel so grateful to have been a part of.
Well, it's kind of astounding to look at your theater past and juxtapose it with your musical present, maybe, or past and present. I mean, because right now it's like you have this great artistic edginess to your music that, and you know, working with Barb and Barb's past kind of punk / rock. Pivots that she's done or they've done in their work, and you know, you look back on your theater stuff and you've got It's a Wonderful Life and the Laramie Project and Peter Pan. It's a lovely, actually it's a really great tapestry of expression across that. Where in all that do you identify the strongest?
Well, so culturally speaking, it's funny. I want to say with It's a Wonderful Life, I was the Foley artist, which was so fun. So there's this theater version of It's a Wonderful Life that's like set up as if it's a radio play from the 50s. And there's a Foley artist on stage making all the sound effects, like people walking and knocking on doors and the crickets. And it was so fun. I loved doing that part. But you know, honestly, I've really come to embrace it all. And I also think, you know, you're bringing up like the kind of the rock side and then this acting side where I'm playing roles that are maybe have a more mainstream flavor. And one of the things about me that I've really come to realize is that I'm a bad girl to the good girls and a good girl to the bad girls. Like that is that is like really where I live. You know what I mean? Like, and it's not a put on. It's not like I'm hiding from being more of a bad girl or I'm scared or whatever. It's just, I live in a sort of in between place. So I do have this like edgier, angrier rock side to me. And also like rebel side that really gets channeled through the politics. But then I also have this kind of friendly, welcoming, you know, open, curious side. And it's all there. And so that's how some of the more, what's the word I'm looking for? Friendlier, more mainstream acting roles can still happen, even though there's the like born under a full moon sapiosexual side of me as well.
Right. Well, it's funny because, I mean, there is a through line where like even It's a Wonderful Life and Laramie Project, both those ask questions. I mean, both those have a question underneath them, you know, and so it's like it's, you know, translating that over to your music, you know, you can see that deeper river running. By the way, you mentioned sapiosexual. I love that song. I love all your stuff, but that one was like, yes, I just, it was like it was so unique. It was like, this is a song that needs to be sung. I just loved a lot about that song. Where did that come from? And you only released that one as a single, I believe.
I did. You know, originally, that was the first song Barb and I recorded together. And originally, that was going to be the first single on the album. But then then partially because of acting stuff, we took so long to finish the album that at some point it just started feeling like, you know what? I think Sapiosexual just lives on its own. It's its own thing. And it's not going to be on the album. But I love that you're bringing up Sapiosexual because, and I'm so psyched you like it. Thank you. Because I really feel like when I learned the word Sapiosexual, like I had like a coming out moment with myself. Like I didn't know that word existed. And it gets even better that we're talking about this unrated LGBT because I was writing one day and for some reason, I can't believe this is all coming together. It's so good. For some reason, I got thinking about Sappho. And then I wanted to know something about Sappho. So I went to my phone, I went to Google, and I typed in SAP, and the drop-down menu had Sapiosexual in it. And I was like, what's that? So I clicked on that instead, being this Scorpio lesbian that I am. I was like, well, I have to know what that is. And I clicked on that, and when I read the definition, which was, and this used to be in the song, and then we took it out, but it was of relating to or concerned with, attraction to intelligent people or something like that. And I was, I literally had this moment of like, oh my God, there's a word that describes who I am that I hadn't really had since I came out, like, which was a while ago now, you know? So it was this very impactful moment, and I wrote the word down, and then later, and one day when like no other song idea was working, I was like, oh, I'll give this a try, and then I was like, this is fun. I want to do this. That is Sappho led me to that song, which I just love so much.
Well, which is interesting because I think I clicked on that song, you know, because this is rated LGBT radio. So, you know, it's like, and I was, you know, I knew what Sapiosexual was, but it was also in there. It's like, is this about that? Or is this about Sappho, you know, the sort of the lesbian icon type thing. But it's, and the thing I love about the song is not like it's a call for yet another recognized channel of LGBTQS, you know, type thing, but it, I think it brings a nuance to sexuality to, isn't this an exciting part of how we can relate to each other and have that be the source of attraction and have that be the exciting thing. And for me, that's a big part of it is like, I love conversation, obviously. Hello, that's what I'm doing. You know, it's like, and it's that relating and having somebody excite you intellectually is such a great thing that is not highly valued in our society and in a lot of our media, a lot of our social media. You know, it's like there's, you know, clickbait and thirst trap, you know, type stuff. And it's like, how about you write a really intelligent post and that be the thirst trap? You know, what wouldn't that be cool?
Wouldn't like, that be cool? Yes. Yes. No, thank you for saying that. And thank you for recognizing that because it really is like a celebration and an indulgence of the feeling rather than like a, you know, a lecture or a political mantle. It's like, let's just have fun with this. You know, let's embrace how good this can feel when, like, you get really jazzed by how someone thinks about something.
Yeah, exactly. And the video with it is perfect tone to me. It was just like, because to your point, it was fun, but, you know, not deep, introspective, but making a really excellent point. And, you know, it's like coloring things really appropriately. So, And we have literally 4 minutes left. Tell us quickly about the upcoming album and what to expect and when we can get our greedy little hands on it.
Ooh, I love that. So the album comes out in September. The album is actually called Watershed Synapse Experience. You're right, that first single was called Born Under a Full Moon, but the album is called Watershed Synapse Experience. It will be out in September. This song out tomorrow, you know, previewed here by you. Thank you so much. And available on all platforms starting at midnight. So, you know, if you follow me wherever you listen to music, then you'll get pinged that the song is out. And there'll be a couple more singles. There's actually going to be a dance song coming out in June, and then another single in August, and then the album in September.
Oh, my God, I cannot wait. And not that you've thought much beyond that, but what is next for you after the album? Theater, acting, film, anyways.
So there's a film playing festivals right now that I'm in a small scene of called Crooked Fingers. So that should be coming out at some point, which is exciting. And then I definitely have some theater stuff in the works, but also, you know, I've been so busy recording the album, finishing the album, getting the album ready to be out that there'll be more live shows after September. So look for those too.
That's super awesome. I hope you get to the West Coast, because that would be great to see you live.
I want to get to the West Coast, so I will let you know for sure. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, our pleasure. Pleasure is mine. And again, so at midnight, go out there and download Water to Blood. Play it for everybody. You know, lift up the consciousness of this. It is a super important issue, and honestly, the song, you'll tap your feet and it'll tap your mind and hopefully motivate us all to do something more about that. And a real pleasure, and if you talk to Barb, give them my best.
I will.
They're
absolutely
awesome to talk to. We, as you can imagine, we were the same way. Blah, 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 blah.
And I can totally imagine. Well, the three of us have to have coffee sometime, I think.
Oh, my God.
Although nobody
that would be
else,
awesome.
That would be amazing. And also, Barb has more reading dates they just posted. So if you're into Barb Morrison, look back for more reading dates, because they're coming up.
Excellent. And unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. We will be back again next week. Also, check out the Los Angeles Blade, losangelesblade.com. And again, thank you. Thank you for being you. Thank you for your work, and thank you for coming on today. And if we do meet up, I would love for the three of us to meet up right in New York City, because that is one of my favorite places on earth as well.
That would be so fun. I really appreciate all your feedback about the work. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
It's my heartfelt assessment, and there you go. And that's it for us for today. We will be back again next week, and we can't wait to talk to you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.